At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.
All right, we're back. It's the steering committee. I'm Ryan Barkey. I'm here with Doug Fogler, as usual, and we've got a special guest. I think we've been hyping this guy up now for a couple of episodes, but Andy Daly is joining us tonight. Andy's a kind of a renaissance man, I think, really, in the truest sense of the word. Andy, I've met you through FuelFed, our car group in Chicago, probably, gosh, 9 or 10 years ago now, I'm guessing. You're an interesting guy. You're a competitive cyclist, right? You're a sailor. You've got a sailboat. Did I see a picture of you flying an airplane on your Facebook page?
No.
What else? Oh, no, that wasn't you? Okay. All right. Well, just run with it. But the real reason we have you on, obviously, is your cars. And you've, you know, I thought it was cool when you rolled up in a Porsche 924S at one of the events, but you're really a French car guy. So usually when we have someone on, we kind of start out with like, what's your car history? What got you into the French cars? What'd you start with? What was your first car?
Well, it wasn't French as far as like the car that was like mine, but it was a lovely 1986 Mazda 323, brown.
Brown gets you points.
Yeah, right. Let's see. Then for a brief spell, I had a 79 Oldsmobile Delta 98, the coupe.
Nice. The velour interior, yeah. And all that. Nice.
It was red when I got it. It was flat black because it had been spray painted by a friend of mine. for some reason, I.
Yeah.
Yeah, that car was fun because on the highway you could literally just watch the gas needle drop.
So was this one of those V8s that had like 140 horsepower?
It absolutely there. It was, you know.
Yeah,
it was nice.
No, I just looked them up real quick, and the first three I've seen have this really bright red interior. That must have been like must have been sort of an option on it at that time. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I sold it to a ska band and then they painted it checkered.
Oh, perfect.
And the engine blew. Yeah. So the perfect ending.
Nice. Nice. And then what? So, I mean, how did you, so you started out with, what, so the, you know, this small Japanese car, you went to the big American car. Were you into cars? Like, I mean, I now, you know, you're all about cars. I mean, were you all about cars then? And,
oh, absolutely. I mean, I guess, like, you know, if you want to talk about, like my first car, in a way, if we go back, is, you know, my dad had a 71 Citroën D Special, and it's only special in that it's the entry-level model.
Okay. And the limited.
Yeah, you know, but, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, it was his graduation present from my grandfather, who also had Citroëns, you know, a bunch of Citroëns. And then that's actually the car that brought me home from the hospital as a newborn. And we still have the car. My dad gave it to me, sold it to me for $1 about 10 years ago. So it's pretty cool to be like, yeah, I own the car that brought me home from the hospital.
That's cool. Pretty cool. When my daughter came home, we had a 911 and we had an old Subaru, and I Actually, I take that back. We had a pretty nice Audi S4 at the time, but I was afraid to park it at the hospital. So she came home in the old beater Subaru. So at least you have a good story. She'll never have a good story. She'll have a good story about her cheap dad, I guess. But Doug's excited to have you on because Doug also grew up with French cars, but kind of the dark side of French cars, right? The Peugeots. What did you have, Doug?
Yeah. I don't know. Is there like a, I'm not familiar. Is there in France, is there like a Ford V, you know, Chevy type thing? And between,
is there a hierarchy?
Yeah. I don't know. I had, just for context. So my mom was really into, she was really into everything French. I was thinking about this today. She wanted everything to be French. So like the house was decorated in like, you know, with French wallpaper and country accents. She had French sunglasses. And of course she had to have a French car. So we had a Peugeot 505 station wagon, like a 1984 Peugeot 505 station wagon, I believe, light blue, the first one. And we had that for a while, and then we got a newer dark blue version of that. I think with actually the V6 engine in it the second time around. So, which was one of the, I was kind of refamiliarizing myself a little bit with these cars, but the second one we still had when I was actually still driving. So that was the first car I drove, and I drove that in high school for about a year. So, yeah, I guess I have more experience with French cars than the average American, but not nearly as much as you, Andy. So,
that was a big virtue signaling thing, right? I mean, to go out of your way to live with a car like that, to track a car like that down, right? I mean, that was never a, well, I mean, I know you grew up on the East Coast, but.
Yeah, I grew up in Massachusetts, and well, I mean, like I said, you know, when I told Ryan this, his jaw kind of dropped because it was like, that's so, you know, unusual and exotic. But there was a Peugeot dealership next town over, you know, at the time when we bought it. So, I mean, it was just a matter of going to that particular dealership and picking it out and driving it and getting it serviced there. So, by the time we got the second one, I mean, by the last couple of years we had that, I mean, Peugeot had pulled out of America, so then it became pretty hard to service, but for most of the time it was just like a regular car. It was actually a really great station wagon, honestly. It was huge. It wasn't a very big footprint, but it had like a lot of interior space. That's what I remember. We could pack so much stuff into that thing, so. But not terribly reliable, I'm not gonna lie.
No,
it was in the shop. Yeah, it was in the shop a lot. So, but I always thought it was a good looking car, even in sedans. But I think the station wagons were really good looking. So I don't know.
Andy, you heard the myth of the French car not being reliable, because you own a shop now, right? We should probably start there and work back. Yeah, tell us about your shop.
Yeah, well, the shop is kind of on a hiatus. So, like I said, I'm a former part-time shop owner. What happens is when you can fix these things, people find out, and then, you know, suddenly people bringing their cars by, and then I tell a friend, and, you know, I've spent the last few years just working out of my garage, and then a friend of mine who also had a Citroen Affliction, and had, I think he has 4 or 5 SMs, and he and I rented some space out in lovely Addison, Illinois, and then I could work on not just one car at a time, but 2, maybe 3. So I did that we had a 2-year lease, so I was like, well, let's try this out for a couple years and see, you know, if I like it or not. And there's definitely, I would have to tell people, like, this is not my normal job. This is, you know, it's nothing more than a glorified a passion project, you know.
Yeah, so, labor of love, huh?
I just, yeah. For people, labor of love, yeah.
Were people, though, like, once they found out, were people really trying to, like, come out to you and drop off their car for work? Was it just, like, were you having to turn down, you know, people, basically? Or
I did, you know, turn down literally 3 people. It's one of those things where it's like, it seemed like, oh my God, so many people are just coming at me. But it's, you know, when you're only doing one car at a time and it takes 6 months to a year to finish it, you know, it's like, I'm busy for the next 18 months. Like, I have 3 cars to work on.
You have to get those parts shipped from rural France, right? You got to build that lag time in, I suppose. Huh?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, like, when you drive these, you know, Western cars around, you know, usually the first question is, like, what is that? It's like, Citroën. What? Citroën.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. Citroën. Who makes it? Citroën. And then, you know, where do you get parts? Yeah. So, sometimes the parts are really easy to get, and then there's just some of those parts that, you know, just kills you, you know, either because it's expensive or, you know, it's unobtainium or, you know, what have you, but, you know. So anyway, I used to have the shop, and then just sort of, I still have one car. I've got some people that I promised to do work on. So, you know, right now I've got a DS sitting in my garage that I've had for almost 2 years now, but that one's been, that one's almost done. It was basically taking the most complicated Citroën DS they made, because it has fuel injection and semi-automatic transmission. And,
You know,
the engine bay is already super crammed, and then the owner wanted to add air conditioning to it. So that was
What year is that one?
That one's 1974. So it's a French market car. So it has the turning headlights and stuff. But
that was a trademark, right? If they weren't complex enough, you would have turning headlights and things like that, right? The covered what was it, the covered license plate in the front was a trademark.
I'm
just shocked. So it had like a semi-automatic transmission back in like 1979. That seems also like pretty ambitious too.
Sort of a Porsche sportmatic type transmission, or
no? It's okay. Well, for starters, it came out in like 1955 is when they came out with the semi-automatic transmission, and it's essentially a sequential shift. So you have a wand where you just kind of go 1, 2, 3, 4 down the line. And it's essentially a hydraulic clutch. So when you lift up off the gas, it disengages what is a normal clutch. Like, it's got a normal clutch fork and all that stuff. And it, you know, will disengage the clutch when you let off of the gas, and then you tap the wand down to second gear. And then when you push back on the gas, it reengages the clutch for you. So it's like a hydraulically actuated, clutch. Yeah, they take a normal manual transmission and plop this hydraulic brain on top of it.
Andy, what was the goal of this transmission? Was it to make it quicker, easier? What was the behind making it more complex? Why would someone opt for that over the, you know, traditional offering?
So, yeah, I mean, I guess the idea is, it's interesting. They had a whole thing about, and you can see this in the Citroëns, you know, for like from the 50s all the way through to the 90s, is they had, you know, they had a focus on safety, and they didn't want you to have to take your hand off the steering wheel. So, you know, you can, like, the honk the horn was never in the center of the steering wheel. It was a little, you know, it was like you basically pull the turn signal stock back, and that was your horn. So you didn't have to take your hand off the steering wheel. So I think the idea is that you could just click on down, like, you don't even have to take your hand off the steering wheel to shift the transmission, because it's on the column.
You know, so like you're kind of like you're just sort of lift. So you lift your foot completely off the gas, clutch is disengaged or engaged. You just kind of click this little stick down, and you're down to the next gear.
Yeah, it's like Tinder. You're like swiping. You're just kind of swiping right, swiping left. With the
swiping
wand,
gear.
Yeah, swiping gear.
Swipe right. Right. Yep.
Yeah.
I'm slowing down.
So, Andy, I remember you telling me too that the customers were really as interesting as the cars too, right? I mean, there's a certain type of person that buys a car like this, right? And then, of course, needs it repaired.
Yeah, no, I mean, it really runs the gamut. I mean, I think for, you know, they're just like it's someone who is definitely not afraid of something that is unknown. Typically, like, definitely a car nerd. A lot of, I'd say like half of the owners are also engineers, because they, you know, can geek out on the complexity. You know, I mean, like, my grandfather and my dad got into them because they're pilots, and there's lots of hydraulic actuations and airplanes, and you know, obviously aerodynamics is an important thing to airplanes, and so it's the same for Citroën at the time. But yeah, there's they're characters for sure. There is a Citroën rendezvous that, of course, it's a rendezvous, but it, you know, it's a gathering of Citroën owners in New York that happens every year. And I've gone with some friends before, and it's a lot of fun because you realize, like, you're looking around like, oh my god, these people, they're all insane. What a bunch of nerds! Like, I'm one of them.
Yeah, just a bunch of people look like kind of wacky college professors, just sort of eccentric, yeah. Sort of like bow ties. That's kind of what I'm picturing. You know, I don't know if these things is that am I close to the mark at all? So.
Yeah, I mean, it's that and everything, and you know, definitely a chip on the shoulder because you know they all, especially for folks who are in the U.S. because you know Citroën left in the U.S. market in '73, and you know already they were kind of like a small brand that no one knew about. So you know, it's like a car for someone who doesn't necessarily care about going all that fast, but definitely wants to get noticed.
Right. Yeah. Well, but you say not fast, but I know that that your car, you have an SM. You still, right?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's a forever car.
Yeah. Yeah. And is that the car they left the States on? I mean, they left on a high note, if that's the case.
Well, yeah. I mean, That's a very nice. You should be in political consulting or something, Ryan, because that's a great way to say that. That's the car that bankrupted them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, but it's a very special car, and for those who are listening who don't know about the SM, and I didn't until I met you, Andy. This is a Citroën with a secret.
Yeah, absolutely. It's got an Italian heart.
Yeah. Not a Fiat engine. It's got a Maserati. engine, right?
Yeah. It's interesting that, you know, in '68, Citroën decided that they wanted to make a coupe, like a GT car, because you know, there was, except for like a Fossil Vega, there were no French GT cars at that time. And, you know, they want to use the DS as the basis for it, but, you know, the DS, frankly, has a pretty pedestrian four-cylinder. You know, it just doesn't even sound all that great. And, you know, it weighs a lot. It's really tall. And they, you know, they just knew they didn't have the capacity to do a sporting engine. So what do you do when that happens? Well, you buy a failing Italian company called Maserati.
So they bought Maserati. They bought the whole company?
Yeah. They bought the whole company.
Okay, I had no idea. Okay. I thought maybe there was a warehouse of freight engines or something. Okay.
They bought the whole company. So, I mean, the neat thing is it was really such, you might think that, you know, Italian engineers, French engineers, like, are at each other's throats. But, you know, there's a book that talks about Maserati during the Citroën years. And a lot of the, you know, the Italian designers, like engine designer Alfieri, who did a lot of the engines, really embraced all the Citroën hydraulic stuff. So that's why, like, the Maserati Bora has Citroën brakes, not because the French told them they had to, it's because Maserati wanted it.
The model that shares that engine?
No, the Bora has a
It's a V8. Normal
Maserati V8. Yeah, so there's the Merak, which is like the baby Maserati Bora. You see pictures of them. The Bora will have like a stainless steel, like brushed stainless steel roof and glass enclosure for the engine. And then the Merak doesn't have the stainless steel roof, and it has like these funky flying buttresses that, you know, go from the back of the roof to the end. It looks, if you look at it too long, you're like, that looks really weird. So in, I think it was, I can't remember if it was like 6 weeks or 6 months, and far too short of a time, Maserati designed the motor for the the SM. So it's a V6, but at 90 degrees. So if you're a Uber car nerd, you'd know that, you know, a V6 should be at 60 degrees. That way you get like an even firing and smooth it out a little bit.
Yeah.
If you do have V6 at 90 degrees, then you end up having to what's called an odd fire. So, you know, you don't have a rhythmic firing of the cylinders. It's almost like a pulsing, like because
is that a packaging thing?
Is that cause?
Yeah, they want.
Yeah, I'm guessing for high low profile center of gravity. Yeah. I assume that means it's more. It's like vibrating more then, right? Like there's more rattling and sort of uneven, sort of like, you know, kind of rattling around in there.
Yeah, I guess it's for me, what it means is that I really know if an engine's tuned correctly. Like I instantly know if, you know, there's something, the timing's off or the carburetors are out of balance. Like I'll instantly know, because if you have everything just perfect, like it's smooth. And if you don't, it's not. So it's kind of a, you know, I've grown to appreciate that, cause like, you know, I can just start up a car and be like, oh, no, okay. You know, something's going on. What's the deal? So it has an easy tell, but it's all, you know, and once you get everything fixed and lined up and have, you know, everything just so, it, they're very reliable, but it's that, you know, the getting there is the fun part. But it's pretty, you know, having pulled, you know, these V6s out of, I think I probably pulled engines out of about a half a dozen cars now. I'm always shocked at how short they are. I mean, they only weigh 300, the engine weighs 300 pounds.
No kidding.
They came in either a 2.7 liter or a 3 liter. And you know, and which is a difference of a whopping 10 horsepower increase for the 3 liter.
Are these SMs all front wheel drive?
Yeah. Mid engine. It's technically front mid, because the engine is behind the front wheels, and then front wheel drive. One interesting thing is, like, you know, so the SM would either had, depending on which engine you had, either the 2.7 or the 3 liter, it was basically 170 or 180 horsepower, which, you know, I mean, it's no Mazda 3 speed or a speed, Mazda speed 3, where you get like insane torque steer when you go over 200 horsepower, but I think this is a great example of how, you know, Citroën and, you know, the French in general, and the Citroën in particular, have novel, I'll call them novel solutions to problems. So, you know, if you have too much horsepower in a front wheel drive car, you get torque steer. Like, so they knew that was going to happen. And they thought,
the best way to handle that is just keep the power below 200.
These cars really are the embodiment of being French, right? I mean, it's just, right? Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not about being the fastest, right? But it's kind of about looking the best and being the smoothest, right? And I've had the pleasure of riding in your SM.
Unlike anything else, right? Yeah, I mean, all the Citroëns from the I think of all of these Citroën sedans and all these later model Citroëns is like, they're like renowned for having like the best ride, like the smoothest, that hydraulic system is just like smooths out any road basically. Is that right? Is that true? I mean, that's what I've always heard.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can just go over railroad tracks at normal speed and all you hear is the tire, like the thump thump of the tire as you go over the tracks. And I guess, you know, the reason for it is that, you know, with any other car, you've got a spring and then you've got you've got something to dampen that spring. But you'll still have, you know, you have to either restrict the spring to keep the thing from like recoiling tons, or, you know, you got to deal with, you know, there's always some little bit of recoil on the shock absorbers. But, you know, when your spring is, instead of being a piece of metal, is just, you know, compressed gas, being pushed up against by some hydraulic fluid, you get the spring action from compressing the air, but there's zero recoil. So like you'll hit a bump and then that's it. You know, so there's no bounce. Mm-hmm. So that's the things I'm getting used to. Now, on the other hand, you know, the concept of like flat cornering is like just not possible. So, you know, it can get a little boaty, and I've learned from doing some of the drives, like where I met Ryan, where we actually, you know, driving a GT car and twisty roads, like basically making it do things it's not really supposed to. I just really learned to like be really smooth about it, and like not have, like kind of let the system load up, so that I can control the that guy. It's like, you know, some serious yaw there. He's like, oh boy, there's some serious.
Although Andy's being a little modest here, in that car, in that SM, I have witnessed him keep up with on paper what you think would be much faster cars, Porsches and other things. And so he's either probably a combination of just being a really good driver, right? And that car being capable in its own way, I guess I would put it, right? And it's once you learn how to
well, plus
how
your how plus your styling background, that comes into play.
Well, maybe that's
I'm a really good sailor.
Yeah, right. Like, we have a 30 degree heel on the car, no problem.
Coming about, watch it.
Yeah. And Andy, refresh my memory. So Citroën still obviously produces cars in France and for other markets. I mean, is a modern Citroën like sort of an evolution of a car like this, or have they become more conventional anymore?
You know, the evil empire of Peugeot came in.
Okay. Yeah, I knew what I was talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean,
I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean they're the next Holden, I think, you know, as far as where things are headed. Just
the
name. Yeah.
Because they just canceled Holden recently, didn't they?
They just canceled Holden. Yeah. I don't know if they're canceling per se, but you know no modern Citroëns have hydropneumatic suspension, and they basically share platforms with Peugeots.
Or like what they did with Lancia. Lancia's, it's
well, right, they're down to one car, right? Which is a,
but yeah. Yeah, but it's a rebat something or other. I don't know. But yeah, it's not.
Yeah,
Pope has one.
Who does?
Yeah, so
Pope.
That's what he did.
Oh,
yeah, right.
Pope. Yeah,
that's the only reason I knew they were still even making them. But interesting. No, I guess I didn't realize sort of the state they're in now. That's sad, because what a storied history and Lancia too, right? So we have a guy in our group that wrote the book about Lancia. When's your book coming out, Andy?
Oh yeah, yeah, right. There's many people know more than me. Have you read that book? I have a friend of mine who has.
No,
a
I haven't. I want to get a copy. No, I'd love to, but yeah. I think even the book was expensive. I'm mistaken.
Oh yeah, no, it's.
Is it about all or particular models?
I think it's about the company, Jeff did like a deep dive, and like went to Italy, talked to people, got the few documents in the factory, and it's probably like telling the story of the company through the cars. I don't know. I'm making this all up. I've never even seen the book, but. I saw the price of it and then found out I had a copy. So like, okay, I need to go borrow that from you.
Well,
wait for the,
wait till it appears in my public library.
E-book, yeah. Well, hey, we should take a quick break. Let's wrap this up and we'll be right back. We're back with the steering committee and talking with Andy Daly, who, again, you're a modest guy, but you're really one of the French car experts, right? I mean, you really are. I mean, you know more French cars than anyone I know. And I've had a repair business, French car repair business. You've got, Citroën SM with the Maserati engine. You still have the 2CV, yeah?
Yeah, still the 2CV. That's pretty much what I was driving. Well, until recently, like my daily driving cars were in the summer was a 72 2CV 6, which means, you know, I joke with people and tell it the 6 means it has the big block because it's 600cc instead of 400cc.
Yeah, let me interrupt you, Andy. When the first times I met you, you rolled up and we had one of our fuel fed our car club meets and meetings in Chicago, and you know, a lot of guys, there were some cool cars. I remember that night, you know, there, I think there was an Aston Martin, a Vanquish, there were, you know, there was a Diablo. I remember, you know, I was very proud of my 997. There are all lots of cool cars. And then you rolled up with this 2CV. And if I remember correctly, you had a bike rack on the top and your daughter, who was probably 4 or 5 years old at the time, in a car seat in this 2CV. You took the cake with that. I mean, all eyes went to you when you rolled up. So that was a pretty cool entrance.
Yeah, you know, it's she's 10 now, so but that's definitely her car. You know, so
that is a cool driver.
In Chicago, no less. Yeah, right. It doesn't like to start when it's under like 40 degrees. That's definitely the, you know, a summertime car. But you know, it will, it is the epitome of like slow car fast. I'll take it on the highway around there, around the city. Cause you know, it's like 60 to 70 miles an hour. If you can do 60 to 70 and if the wind's going the right way, I can do 70 in that car. It's floored. You have it like driving on the highway is your foot is on the floor. And there's nothing more liberating than that.
10 tenths all the time.
Yeah, 10 tenths. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it has these tiny little tires, and you'd be shocked at how well that thing corners. And it has it doesn't have a single anti-roll bar. You can walk up to the car and just grab it by the roof line and shake the car back and forth. Like, you know, you get a foot of rock. But as I was talking to someone once about, like, I can't believe, you know, because I kind of bought the car on a whim, and I thought, I can't believe how well this tiny little car with, you know, little bicycle wheels, how well it corners. Like, I can't, you know, I'm sure it will definitely oversteer because it's front wheel drive, but it grips. And someone told me, like, well, it leans over so much. So it has a front, has a trailing suspension arm in the back, and then that's kind of the reverse in the front. So I'm not sure what you'd call that, whatever is the opposite of trailing, a leading control
leading
arm. Leading arms. So when you hang a corner, take a corner, and the thing leans way over, you effectively lengthen the wheelbase on one side, and it helps you maintain grip.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, it's like the geometry in that is like, it's like I'm trying to figure that out in my head, but yeah. That's all it is, right? It's just that trailing arm, right? There's not like a traditional shock absorber or anything in it, right? It's just that arm that's anchored sort of at the front, and then it kind of goes to the back, and then that just has a lot of play on it, right?
Yeah, well, there's this big, huge spring in a canister that is like parallel in line with the frame, so parallel to the ground, and then the suspension is tied into those, and so the front interacts with the back, so you have this like, you know, crude self-leveling apparatus. So that's how, like, you know, when you load up the front, then it gets the rear ready for the whatever bump you're about to hit. I mean, I'm sure for passengers, they're like, dear Lord, what is happening?
Wasn't this a car that was created really as an agricultural appliance? Wasn't there a Top Gear, an old Top Gear episode where they're driving one across a plowed field at high speed or something? I mean, this really was.
Yeah, kind of marketing gimmick or like what the design. It's like post World War II, everything's, you know, destroyed. And they want to have a car that's cheap and, like, you know, for farmers to be able to get into town and sell the, sell their eggs. You know, this, you might find this, I should should mention this is a bit of an aside, but you know, since I know this is there's lots of Porsche talk, and we can talk about a 924S here in a second. But I have to say that, have you guys heard the Citroën factory story as it relates to Sir Porsche himself?
No. I'm very interested to hear that.
So, you know, it's World War II. Germans are in Paris, and they tell Citroën that they, on their summer holiday, doing whatever they were doing then.
It got a little out of hand.
Yeah, got a little angry. Yeah. And but you know, they wanted Citroën to make they're doing army trucks, like, you know, transport trucks, whatever. And
continue. This is a good story.
So they couldn't figure out why the trucks just kept failing, like the engines would just blow left and right. So, you know, they sent Sir Porsche to the factory to figure out what was going on, and you know, he's looking around trying to figure out if, like, you know, they're forging the cranks wrong, or you know, putting the wrong bearings in. So they seize, and it's like, no, it's all good. Couldn't figure it out. But he had to figure out to check and see where they were doing the notches on the dipstick. So what someone was doing was putting a notch a lot lower than it should be, so it'd oil starve the motors, and then they'd seize.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. La resistance. Yeah,
there you go.
It's great. Yeah, no, I've heard that story. I think it's great. I think the only bad
elegant in its
it's brilliant. I mean, it's elegantly, you know, brilliant in terms of how they did it. I feel like the only knock against it is that, like, I feel like did everyone in Germany for the next like 40 years assume that French cars were just unreliable? I mean, I you know, there was like
they
sacrificed. Well, I know, but they sacrificed like their reputation, but to, you know, for the betterment of the entire world, you know, for freedom and you know, the downfall of fascism and tyranny. But it's like, at what cost? But I love that story. Now, you're right. Once you started telling it, I was like, oh, I do recall that. Yeah, it was a great story. So
yeah. I mean, who knows if it's actually true? But that's what.
I've heard it in enough places that I'm going to go ahead and we'll go ahead and just call it. In this day and age, I mean, what is truth anyway? So we'll just.
It works for me.
That is true. So yeah.
So, I cut you off earlier, Andy, when you were talking about your car history, and you went from this Mazda 323 to this Oldsmobile, and so I'm still trying to bridge the gap between that Oldsmobile and sort of, you know, where you are these days. What came after the Oldsmobile?
Well, then I decided that, you know, the only thing better than a Mazda 323 is a Mazda 929. So I had that for a little bit.
The natural progression, right? Yeah.
Climbing the Mazda corporate ladder. So,
yeah, exactly. By then, I just moved to Chicago. This is like 1999, so I was like a recent college grad, feeling real fancy.
Where'd you grow up, Andy?
It's 99. So I kind of grew up all over, but mainly in Ohio. My dad was in the Air Force, so you know, we moved all over. Yeah. But then in 99, so my grandfather, who was actually lived in Colorado Springs. Because he spent the last part of his career at the Air Force Academy, and he had three Citroën DSs, and then I found out randomly that he was giving them away. Like, he gave one away to a mechanic in Denver to help him keep the other two running, and then he gave away a really nice one that I remember, you know, thinking that was awesome. And so here I was, you know, like a 23-year-old just moved to Chicago, and so like, oh my God, my grandfather's giving away Citroën. So I, you know, I called him up and I was like, hey, do you still, you know, like, what about the 72? And he's like, no, still have it. You want it? Sure. Okay. And, he and my grandmother, drove out from Denver with the car, and, it's pretty funny because they drove it in the thing, like, on the way there, apparently like a muffler fell off. So the thing was like super loud. And it had a bit of rust on it, and the doors didn't lock, and he just put it in the, you know, like a parking lot near the Art Institute, because he really wanted to go to the Art Institute. And so it's funny, because after work, I meet him at the Art Institute, we walk around, and he's like, oh yeah, by the way, here's the keys. It's in that parking lot over there. You got to pay the parking to get it out. And by the way, the doors don't lock. And I didn't have a garage at the time. I was like, oh my God.
So, and where does the DMS fit in as far as like the, I don't know, the Citroën Arc, or, I mean, you know, the 2CV obviously is iconic. You hear a lot about the SM just, you know, by virtue of the Maserati engine and all that. The DS is a little more, I don't want to call it unloved, but it's a little more under the radar, right? But yet it's still this iconic sort of car.
Yeah, I think, I mean, actually it's probably like their most well-known car.
Is that just because they made the most of them, or?
Well, I think they made more 2CVs, but like the DS is really, you know, when it came out in 55, it was just like, I mean, it was a kind of a mic drop, you know, because
that's
so many things.
Yeah, but, amazing looking car for 55. I guess I didn't realize.
This must have been, I mean, this must have been like, this is a spaceship in 1955. I mean, it's so, I mean, the style on it is still considered, I mean, I still see sci-fi movies where they use this car to represent, like, you know, future cars. I mean, it's like, it's insane.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Being a Citroën nerd, I can rattle them off for you. You know, it's like Back to the Future, it's a Taxi, and Back to the Future. It's in Gattaca.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Gattaca. There you go. Those are the two I would have gotten. I don't know if I can go past that, but and I feel like it was this also the car that, isn't there like a famous story of like Charles de Gaulle escaping an assassination attempt or something in one of these? Or maybe it wasn't de Gaulle.
Yeah.
It might have been.
No, yeah. It was
one of the African dictators or something. Or was it Charles de Gaulle?
No, it was. Yeah, it was de Gaulle. Although it's funny. Apparently the assassins also were driving DSs. So I don't know. Like, it was really.
So everyone could was using
SM. Equal footing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, it's, you know, in 55, they came out with a car that, you know, had disc brakes in the front, and it's interesting that the disc brakes are inboard, so they're huge, like, because they're not confined to the, you know, the space of the rim, and also with them inboard, the wheels are, you know, unweighted, so that, you know, that sprung weight is even less, you know, and they had, like, you know, for 55, like, they had some crazy safety things, like, well, they actually came with seat belts. But they had, you know, crumple
groundbreaking.
They crumple zones, like the spare tire is in the front underneath, is in the front and the hood, and they wanted a, you know, some sort of cushion for head-on collisions. That's, you know, the steering wheel is, you know, the iconic steering wheel, which is one spoke. But if you imagine that you're driving the car, that spoke when you're going straight is supposed to be, if that was a clock, it'd be at like the 7 or 8 o'clock position. Now, I don't know if this is actually helpful or not, but the idea is that if you get into a head-on collision, the steering wheel actually will break on that, the pivot of the spoke, and it's supposed to push you towards the center of the car instead of away. Like, I don't know. That's probably airbags are a little bit better than, you know, relying on a steering wheel to break.
Well, it's a nice car.
They're trying.
Quick, speaking of dictator cars and all that, did you happen to catch the Tatra? And I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. That was on Jalopnik recently. That supposedly belonged to Yasser Arafat and the PLO. And I was looking at that's really familiar. Frank Vosnak had that in his garage, and he was taking pictures. Those are Frank Vosnak's photos on Jalopnik a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if you happened to see that.
No, I didn't see that. Oh my God.
Photography. Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Those are awesome cars.
Yeah. So DS, so you had the DS as a young man in Chicago, and that had to been pretty cool, right? I mean, and did you drive that for a few years or?
Yeah. So I drove that, and then, you know, that car had 240,000 miles on it.
Oh, wow.
It had some rust on it that was, you know, just, you know, I just wasn't up to the challenge of fixing it.
Yeah. But I'm sorry, I ended up, you said 240,000 miles on it?
Yeah. 240,000 miles on it. Yep. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Was he ever based over in France? Is that where he kind of it sounds like he had kind of an initial love for these kind of cars. We had three of them. Was he like ever based in Europe or something? Or
He originally got interested in them in the late 50s. I think mainly just because of the aerodynamics. He was an aeronautical engineer, so he just really geeked out on the aeronautical aspect of it. You look at the top of a, if you're looking over top of a DS or an SM, the rear track is actually narrower than the front because they wanted a teardrop shape. Which makes for like very nervous driving when you try and get one of these on under a four post car lift. But any sort of travel, you need a protractor to get the angles right.
Okay. Good for low coefficients of drag, though.
Yeah, at least at the time, you know. He was definitely like big into sculpture and stuff like that, and probably the most interesting thing he did in the Citroën was, of course, you know, to imagine doing that drive in this day and age is insane, but in the 60s it was not as insane, but at the time he was stationed in a place called Karachi, Pakistan. This is in the 60s. He had a DS, and you know, normal sane humans, if they needed it, he got reassigned to London, and you know, normal people would probably fly. And he decided that, well, what I really want to do is drive this old DS to Paris and pick up a new one, and then drive that new one to London. So my dad was already in college at this time, but you know, they drove through Pakistan, Afghanistan, along the like Soviet border,
That's the thing. Yeah, he couldn't even drive through Russia if he needed to. Then you had to avoid Russia.
Yeah,
that's insane.
Yeah, yeah,
that must have been quite a trip.
Yeah, so it's definitely in the blood, I think, as far as, you know, sometimes some people ask me, like, why on earth are you into these cars? And it's like, how could I not be?
Yeah. So you hung on to that for a few years?
What's that?
You hung on to that for a few years then in Chicago, and then what came after that? Or what happened to that car?
I sold it to a guy in Florida, and then he sold it to someone else. I'm not sure what happened to it.
Sure.
It's still in Florida somewhere. But that's when at the same time, my dad was, hey, you know, if you want the Citroën DS I have, like, now's the time. So that car, it's a little simpler. It was not like doesn't have the leather interior and all that stuff, but that's pretty much, for all intents and purposes, it's rust free and still has the original paint job, and it was just, you know, just a much nicer car. But, you know, so that I got that, and then for whatever reason, because it was so nice and I was almost scared to work on it, I thought, I need a project Citroën, like, you know, too many is never enough. And this is what, 2010, when I, for whatever reason, I decided, like, I had to have an SM. These things are the best. So awesome. I gotta have one. And at the time, you know, this is like 2009, 2010. To me, when I was looking, not just because I don't, Citroën file, I just thought, like, you know, when someone tells you, you know, leave out the Citroën part and just say, how about a European GT car that, you know, has a all-aluminum Italian V6, will do, and theoretically, 140 miles an hour, can cruise 100 miles an hour all day long. Mid-engine, you know, air conditioning, heat, full leather interior, all that stuff. And then say, okay, what if I tell you that the best example in the world at that time cost $25,000? You know? And if you want to spend an extra, you know, $5,000 or $10,000, you can get the not carbon fiber rims, but they're like this fiberglass resin rims that came on the rally cars. So you get like, have like the rally spec version. So to me, it was like a no brainer. Of course, I didn't have $25,000; I had more like $5,000. So I went and found the crappiest car that didn't have any rust on it. I mean, that thing was, you know, everything was wrong with it. The engine was came in a box. So, you know, built that guy up. That's the car that Ryan saw probably, you know, a few years later after I finally had it running.
So you built up your own SM, and then
you also ended up
getting the one that you were that your family had had, you know, the one that you came home in the hospital as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So did you have three Citroens at one time, or were you only at two at one time? What happened with the project one, and then the birth one? We'll call it that. So
yeah, well, the when I was so currently I have the DS that was my dad's. I've got the SM, and then I've got a 2CV. So three.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. So you have the hard to keep up.
But that's not everything.
It is, so it's hard to keep up with all the letters and numbers. So it's the 2CV, the DS, and the SM. Those are the three, and you have all three of those currently in your stable.
Yeah, still have all those three.
Yep.
And the, that's yeah, not all like, in your stable.
Just calling it a stable. No, there's also an 87 924S.
So we got to talk about that car.
Because when I was in Chicago,
so it's tough enough being a car guy in Chicago, right, for all the obvious reasons. And it's one of the reasons that pushed me to Colorado, because I wanted to at least have a few years of my life where I had access to these great roads, right? But for years, I lived in this neighborhood in Chicago called Wicker Park, and there was this white 924 Porsche parked on the street, and I would walk past it every day on the way from the train to my house and didn't really think much of it. It looked a little rough. I didn't know enough about Porsches at the time to realize that it was more than your everyday 924. Well, fast forward a while, and you ended up buying this car that I used to walk past every day, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it must be. Yeah, because I bought it from a kid that lived, you know, by that time I wasn't living in Wicker Park, but, you know, it was near North Side. So, I mean, how many white 924Ss are parked on the street?
Yeah, no, I'm sure it was the same car. And, so the 924S, refresher, so the 924S actually has the 944 powertrain in it, right? And how did the 924S come to be? The 924 was out of production. They needed a car that I used to think it was something about they had extra body shells or something, but I think the real story was that they wanted the 944 had gotten so expensive at that point that they effectively brought the 924 back into production, but with the more powerful 944 powertrain. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I guess the one little tweak there is that the 924 never went out of, like in Europe, it was always for sale. Like in the US, it left. I don't know if it was like, probably around the time the 944 came out, like, so early 80s, they stopped bringing 924s over to the U.S. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, the Deutsche Mark is so expensive, they're like, we need a cheaper car. What can we do? Like, let's lower the compression. So in 87, they lowered the compression, I think, with pistons on a 944.
Yeah, they're still doing that. We were just talking about the 718 718s GTSs that are coming out now with the six cylinder that's, you know, slightly detuned from the GT4s and the new Spyder. It's like, there's something about, you know, it's maddening when they detune an engine like that, but I understand why.
Yeah.
I guess they've been doing it for a while, I guess. Maybe it's part of their heritage.
So the
924 was still available in Porsche dealerships in Europe, but like it left the U.S. market, in 86 they bring it back as like the new entry level model, like the least expensive Porsche at the time, I guess. And it's
It's 87 they bring it back.
87. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it looks like a 924, but it has like the engine and the drivetrain of a 944, like the base 944, I assume.
Yeah, I mean it's a 924, and they just dropped in the 944 engine. And it's funny because they only did it for 2 years. So it's 87 and 88. So the 87 ones, it seems like there's a lot more of those, or that people are more willing to sell them, because I see a lot more of those for sale. And then in 88, I guess they decided, like, they're kind of like, screw it, let's just put the 944 motor in it. So those are a little better in the sense that you get the extra, you know, you get the same horsepower you get in a natural aspirated 944. And then 88,
so not detuned at all, just a straight engine.
Exactly.
Yep.
Actually. Yep.
Okay.
And you all also get the 88s, is when they also had what is the sessions, you know, what would now be like a club sport, but they called it the special edition. And it's special in that you pay more.
Good name for it.
Yeah. So,
get more. Oh, yeah. So they've been playing that scam on us for a while, too. You pay more, you get less, type of thing. Yeah.
I mean, it's like you get your AC delete, and you know, you get one less rearview mirror. I mean, you do get like a rearview mirror.
I mean, that was just so unheard of. That would be so unheard of now.
Yeah.
I had an 1881 320 BMW was my first car, and it only had the driver's side mirror. You know, and it just, can you imagine that now, even on the cheapest car? I mean, they were doing that on a Porsche, right?
Yeah. For aero, who knows? And it's actually a smaller mirror as well. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But you know, that's actually like a car that I would, people have kind of, you know, figured out about the 924 SE, and we should talk about the one that sold on Bring a Trailer recently for, what was it, like, it was over 30 grand. Granted, that's a car there right now.
39,000.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, it only had 8,000 miles on it. It's funny, when I saw the posting, you know, Ryan, you mentioned, mm-hmm. I wasn't aware of the, I try and avoid Bring a Trailer as much as possible because it just hurts sometimes. Yeah. So when you mentioned to me, I went and looked, and I was like, 8,000 miles. Doesn't everyone know that like those odometers only have 5 digits, and half the time those odometers are broken? Then you start looking at the car, and you're like, oh, like everything is perfect on the car. Like the dash is cracked. Like there's, you know, there must be like a feeling that you could quantify for the feeling of seeing, you know, bolts still nickel plated from the 80s and 70s.
Mm, wow.
Like, seeing old nickel plated stuff, you're just like, ooh, nostalgia.
Yeah. Yeah. Did they do a martini livery version of the 924 S at one point, too?
I think it was just the 924.
Talk about martini. Unfulfilled promise. Because there was a big performance difference between the regular 924 and the 924S. I mean, right, it was significant, like many seconds quicker in the, you know, to 60 or something, right? It was a big jump.
Yeah, although I think like the 924 Turbo and the 924S are pretty comparable. It's just that, you know, it's so much easier and so much less hassle to do that with a 924S.
I only recently driving. Go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah,
I was just gonna say, I remember test driving in high school. I was shopping for my first new car, and there just happened to be this beautiful it was just a regular 924. It was probably a 78 or 79. It had been a trade-in at a Ford dealer, some domestic brand locally. And it was really beautiful, and it was cheap, right? It was $3,000 to $4,000, but it was an automatic. And I think that was one of the slowest cars I've ever driven, maybe a 3-speed automatic. I don't know, but even as a, you know, 16-year-old, I thought, yeah, this is too slow. I mean, I like the idea of having a Porsche, but with that automatic, just hobbled it so much. But for us, that they were neat cars, and of course, you know, the history with Volkswagen and Audi and all that. What they originally going to be marketed? We're talking about the early ones, right? Late 70s. They were going to be marketed as sort of a co-branded Porsche Volkswagen, or they were going to be a Volkswagen, and then
Volkswagen was paying Porsche for it, and then Volkswagen thought, like, actually, we're gonna do this thing called a Golf, see a Porsche. We don't want your car.
They just kind of left them up on Porsche, holding the bag with it.
Did Volkswagen?
I can't remember. Did Volkswagen? They didn't own Porsche until much more recently, right? I mean, that's they just had like a close relationship, I guess, at that point. But
it is interesting with the even with the 924S, like you can look at some of the switches, like the hazard switch that's Volkswagen on it, or you know VW, you know, finding things like there's parts on the 924 and then therefore the 924S that cross reference to a Super Beetle.
Oh wow! So it's like the new Supra, Andy.
Yeah. Oh my God. Fascinating. Have you ever sat in one of those?
No, but I want to ask you because you and some of the Fuel Fed guys went to the Chicago Auto Show recently on press day, right?
Yep.
Like,
yeah,
big shots.
We were faux press people, like pretty much everyone else there. I mean, it's the only way to go see an auto show, which is when no one else is there and for free. Yeah, that's the only time you should go to an auto show, I think.
Fair enough. Yeah, we got to figure out how to do that. We got to really game the system.
That's for the world-renowned Denver Auto Show.
So, yeah.
I mean, you guys have a podcast. There's no way you can't get in.
That's fair. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, we'll
make sure.
You just need to get
someone who
cards.
That's way. Hey, we have those. We do have those.
We have cards.
Andy, who has such an eclectic car history. I mean, I don't even know if we've talked about everything. Isn't there a BMW in your current stable too? I think that your wife drives. Is it an E30 or am I making that up?
It's an E93. It's a former spouse.
Newer one. Okay.
She has, so
okay.
It's now
okay.
Former spouse.
Okay. Well, we need to talk offline. But, anything else in the stable right now? I guess what I'm getting at is when you've got these cars and the newest one is, you know, several years old, many years old now, right? I mean, when you go to something like the Chicago Auto Show and you see all these new cars, is there anything that does anything for you? I mean, I saw some pictures of the GT4 you sent over. There was a Buick in there too. I mean, that's what you were into. I mean, what catches the eye of someone like you?
Yeah, like my current daily driver and my newest car is a 2002, wait for it, Mazda Protege 5. I was telling the guys when we went to the auto show, I was like, I'm here to see which car I'm going to buy in 15 years. When it's gone to even the best cars have that descending, where they get to the bottom and then everyone forgets about them. Yeah. The idea is you buy them right before everyone figures out that they're kind of cool and they start climbing back up.
That's right. Yeah. You gotta get them at the bottom of the depreciation trough. Before people pick up on them again. So.
Yeah. I mean, for the past 5 years, I've just been wringing my hands at I gotta get a 996. I gotta get a 996. Everyone thinks they're awful.
They've come up so much in the last couple of years. I mean, you could get for $10,000-$12,000 there for a while, and in early career.
Yeah.
And I mean, now they're, I think even the cheap ones are 18 or 19. It's, and they do look good to me now. Like 2 years ago, they didn't. What is that? Why do they?
That's what I'm talking about.
Look good all of a sudden, is that because it's everyone else is thinking the same thing? It's maddening.
No,
you've got a pretty good record of buying low and selling high, or buying low and hanging on to these cars. I mean, right? I mean, the SMs. I don't know if they still are, but a couple of years ago, they were really expensive. No.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've plateaued off. I mean, there was a couple the best example went from 30,000 to itching at 100,000. But then the four people in the entire world who would pay that much got their car. And then it came back down.
The market it's stabilized at this point.
Yeah. If you want to make money, then the last thing you do is buy a car. You invest that money, for me, it's always been what is the cheapest point of entry to get something that, I shouldn't be able to own, but can, cause I've nerded out and figured out what other people don't think is valuable. So it's annoying to hear that 996s are on the rise. Cause definitely I've been oh my God, I should get one. I feel like they're on their uptick right now. I still think there's still some value in them, but like they are starting to creep up. I mean, the early, like the 98, 99, 2000, like the fried egg headlamp style ones, those are still the least expensive ones to get. But I'm just kind of doing a quick look on
crazy.
Bring a trailer. So
yeah. So the funny thing is that I went down the rabbit hole with this, and like the 99.996 is the one you want because of the you know, the IMS bearing is actually better than later iterations.
The 99, really? But,
yeah, I think
interesting.
I think this, you know, it's like the fail rate on the later ones is like 3%, and then with the 99s it's like 1%, and it's because the bearing was, the IMS bearing is wider, or it's like a double row or something. It's been a while since I went down that deep rabbit hole, but you know.
Yeah. Is 99, is that the first year of that, or is there a 98?
First year, yeah. I think so. Yeah,
okay. No, it'd be weird if they changed it for 1 year and then changed it back or something. So okay. So 99 is the one if they're gonna do it.
Yeah, so that's a pro tip for the day. It's totally counterintuitive because you think like never buy the first year of a car.
Yeah, right.
But
they changed one thing that almost ruined the whole model. Yeah, the second year. That's really strange. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I agree with Ryan, I think, and you. It's like I didn't like these for so long, and then suddenly, I don't know, the looks of them have just really grown on me. I like them. Probably not my favorite 911, but I just have grown to appreciate them a lot more than I ever did when they were, I remember when they were new. I remember when they, came out, and obviously the backlash against them for being, the sin of being air cooled to begin with, let alone that was before people knew that they, had this
water cooled rather. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Sorry. The sin that they weren't air cooled. And then,
We'll get letters. Yeah, we'll get letters, Doug.
Yeah. I know. I feel like I just lost all my, my street cred there. Yeah, that's
well,
that's it.
So, but Doug doesn't even care about 911s. Yeah. Doug just wants a Cayman, right? I mean, that's really, you're the only guy I know that actually, well, not the only one, but I mean, you really, it's the Caymans that do it for you. So that's,
we've talked about this
a lot, but
yeah. I think the first generation Cayman's one of the best looking cars Porsche's ever made, and also, and one of the best looking cars made, period. So,
that's a car I think looks so much better now.
Yeah, and when it really grown into its looks too. For some reason, I always thought it looked a little odd when it was new. Like I thought, like the A pillar was like too high or something, and it almost looked like it was, I don't know, like disproportional. But since then, I feel like I've gotten over it. I don't know, maybe just my as I get older, I just get more mellow with my sort of design aesthetic. Appreciation or something.
Yeah, I think those look better. I mean, I've got, the 718 Cayman. I think that original Cayman is a better looking car from most angles than the newer one. I really do. It's just, but Porsche has a way of doing that, right? Like, I mean, the cars, the new 992 that came out, I mean, didn't do much for me. And now it's been around for a year or two. And it's really coming to its own. Porsche's got a way of doing that, I guess, but.
Yeah, they grow on you, I guess, the looks of them. Yeah. So,
you got to wonder if they do that on purpose. Like they've got some design sneaky voodoo that they can bake in there.
It's all come on. By accident, right?
No, it's all scientific. It's like you will slowly fall in love with this car. It'll grow on you.
Yeah.
Just trust us. You'll be clamoring for 992s and whatever. What's the new one? The 99. The newest one. That 20 years from now, that's the one people will be like, oh, I love those. Those are the best. Like they're too big now. We should go back to the 2019, 2020, 911s. They're so small.
That's right. Should wrap this up. So, I want to come right back, and I've got a question for you, Andy. About what's next for you. So let's wrap this up. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back with the steering committee and talking to Andy Daly. And you mentioned you were at the Chicago Auto Show, and sounded like you had an interesting opportunity to sit in on an Audi presentation about electric cars. And I want to ask you about that because we conveniently avoid talking about electric cars. Most shows, don't we, Doug? It's just, I don't know. Neither one of us have really, I don't know, become enamored with the idea or the I don't know. They haven't caught us yet. So, what about you? I mean, you don't have anything electric in the fleet. You said in this presentation. I mean, do you see yourself buying an electric car at any point soon, Andy?
Well, like I said, I have to wait 15 years probably to buy it.
That's right. Batteries need to be replaced.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we were there on a press pass, and we were not members of the press. But, you know, our fearless leader, Brian, had also gotten us lunch tickets to, like, you know, this keynote speaker, which I didn't even know who was talking. I just knew that we were going to get, like, free lunch. but, yeah, it turned out to be someone from Audi talking about their, you know, the latest and greatest in e-tron. I mean, you know, so it was interesting. One thing they had, it was, you know, the very slick PowerPoint presentation, and it talks about, like, you know, the current system of basically energy delivery, where if you have a car that runs on gas, you go to a gas station, you fill up, done, right? And then, like, you've got some big trucks that bring the gas to the gas stations, and there's always gas stations everywhere. And then they throw up this, you know, the diagram of, like, what needs to happen in order for, you know, the electronic grid to work for electronic car, you know, electric cars. And it's like, you know, you need government buy-in and like, you know, all these things have to line up. And it's like, okay, well, that's, you know, that's far off and, like, looks real complicated. But, you know, if you live in the city, I mean, I don't know about you guys living in Denver, but, you know, in Chicago, it's like electric cars all over the place, you know, Teslas, I live in Chicago, my parents are in Dayton. Like, if I had a Tesla, you know, there is a supercharger in Lafayette, which is Indiana, which is kind of like halfway. So, you know, you can see how it would work. But, you know, I think there's something about, it seems real complicated and also just like super expensive. Although one thing that they mentioned was, like, it's interesting, like, I forget like the specs of it, but the presentation talked about the price of a battery as far as a kilowatt hour. And he's basically saying, like, once it gets below this level of a kilowatt hour, and he had a graph of, like, how the battery technology is getting better and it's getting cheaper and cheaper. It's like, once it gets below this, then it's cheaper to buy an electric car than a gas engine car. So, I mean, when that happens, you know, but it's, I don't know, I think it's really hard to make the case where, like, this is a car that I want to go, and I got to go do 300 miles today because I'm driving someplace. You know, if it's like if you're bopping around the city, you know, it's much easier.
I don't think I'll be passionate about any electric vehicle. I mean, I think I will just think of it. That truly will be just an appliance for me. But, you know, if I ever were to purchase one, but if I were, it would be like, my life right now is very localized, where my office is very close to my home and my daughter's schools are all very close. So I could, like, almost get away with it, but it would be just sort of like the kind of city runabout car, but not the kind of car. It certainly couldn't be the only car I had right now. I'd have to have something that I feel like could do the long range and could do the long distance type thing and could, you know, get out of that range anxiety type thing that I have. But I think I could do, I could live with like almost like a Kia Soul, you know, shaped sort of car, something like very boxy and very practical just to drive around and just do, you know, quick trips around the city with. But,
that's what appeals to me, but really more the commuter car, the Nissan Leaf type of electric car, you know, here in Denver, obviously the status symbol, I'm sure like it is in Chicago, is, you know, the Tesla or whatever. That's, you know, I wanted to talk about an appliance car. That's what I want for my appliance car. That's what I want to replace our Volkswagen Tiguan. I mean, that's just running errands and all that. And I want my Porsche for the weekend. We talked a little bit on the last episode, Andy, I don't know if you listened, but sort of the analog for us were mechanical watches versus digital watches, quartz watches, right?
Yeah.
and how in the 70s, you know, I mean, kind of like cars, right? Like, I mean, the quartz watches were very expensive at first. It was a new technology. You know, I mean, they had a certain look. I mean, everyone sort of cast their expensive or once expensive mechanical watches aside for these new quartz watches. And, you know, that didn't last very long. And now you could argue that the quartz watches are the beaters, the everyday cars, the, you know, the commuter, you know, car equivalent. And, but the nice cars or the nice watches rather, you know, whether it's a Rolex or a Patek Philippe or whatever, are exclusively mechanical watches again, even, and they played with, you know, quartz movements for a while in the 70s and, you know, eventually rejected it. But, you know, so yeah, I guess now I should say I have not driven a Taycan. I've never even seen a Taycan in person yet. So yeah, that could,
they had one at the auto show. And so I got to sit in it, and it was pretty cool to sit in it.
2.5 seconds or whatever it is, 2.1 seconds, 0 to 60. I mean, that's gotta be amazing.
Too fast.
But well, also $240,000.
Like, I feel like it's gonna liquefy our organs. That's what I'm worried about. But
yeah,
it is,
well, you know, in a better, right? Like, it better.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I mean, all that torque and everything just right off the line and just seamlessly just taking off. But
It just sounds painful when I read those numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. it's gonna have an effect on it. And also there's not much, we're gonna have to stop doing 0 to 60 because there's not much time left now between, you know, some of these cars. They're already dipping into the, you know, we're at mid twos and we're gonna be at the 2 second range pretty soon. And they're gonna have to do like, you know, 0 to 80 or something. Yeah.
Yeah, that was always the worst performance sort of parameter anyway, right? I mean, you know, how many shifts do you have? I mean, that can make or break a car 0 to 60 time. How many shifts do you have? You
know,
zero to sixty. And so, I mean, yeah, there's just, I always thought the quarter mile, I think, you know, quarter mile time is just a more realistic, but yeah, it's just, you know, you've seen these drag races on YouTube and all that between, you know, a very fast, internal combustion car. I mean, you've got to have something that's all wheel drive for starters, right? Just to even get close to a, you know, a powerful electric car. It's just, I don't know. We'll see. It's one of those things, I guess, you know, we've touched on it a little bit, but just, I don't think either one of us have the experience with electric cars yet.
I'll jump in on one thing here though. It will solve one constant ongoing, you know, sense of tension in my household, at least with my wife, I love her to pieces, but for some reason thinks that, like, you don't have to put gas into internal combustion engines when you drive the car. Like, you can just drive it around on, you know, like pushing it on empty as long as possible. And it's like, get her a car and get her the home charging, I'll just go out and make sure that the car's plugged in every night.
You got to remember to plug it in. I won't. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a source of not super tension, but it has, except for the time when we shared a car for a while, and then I went to go drive the car and basically went to start it up and the car wouldn't start because it was out of gas. Yeah.
Oh wow.
Oh my god. But yeah. No, that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for marital bliss. I'll get her an electric car and just let her, you know, just have her charge it every night and she comes home. So,
well, that's the next step, right? We're going to have these like charging pads that the car drives on, and it's going to be like, you know, the charging pad for your phone, right? If you've got, I forget what they call that anywhere, it really is.
Yeah.
You don't have to do anything. Right. So,
it's true. But, well, it makes me nervous. I give credit, I think, to Smoking Tire for mentioning this. It's like, I'm going to come out someday and there's going to be like a cat like fried underneath one of those pads. I think the plug-in is fine. I'll stick with that for now because I don't want to find like squirrels or rabbits or whatever just like cooked underneath the car. Yeah. So, that's my little hope for the future. So I don't care about the environment. I just want her to be driving a car that always has charge.
And Andy, she doesn't listen to this anyway, right, Doug? So.
Yeah. No. So I think she's, well, we've I think gone she's way, not in, we've gone she's way not in too, the next room, so, yeah.
We've gone way too long. We usually try to keep these around an hour, and we've gone way over. But I know we've only scratched the surface with the Andy, so I really appreciate you coming on. And
secretly yeah. hoping to yeah, get more of our you. Fuel-fed brothers to listen, and you know, and this thing will grow a little bit because once they know you're on, they're all going to want to listen. I know. So, but hey, we got to catch up. We got to do this again. And I obviously missed you on our usual fall drive this year that we do. So hoping we get a drive in soon. And if nothing else, maybe get a group of guys to put a drive together out here. But really appreciate your time, Andy. I know you're very busy. You got a million things going on. And when I said you're a Renaissance man, I wasn't kidding. So really interested to hear from you and hear about your stable and your adventures and how you've gotten into French cars. Really appreciate your time. But let's absolutely do this again.
Yeah, absolutely.
I concur with Ryan.
Absolutely. Right. You know, we're looking at doing a trip to good old Colorado at some point in time. So, you know, if you guys are ever in Chicago, by all means, look me up.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I didn't even get to ask you about your other trip to Colorado in the SM that you made. So we'll save that for the next time I talk to you. But
there you go.
All right. Well Doug and Andy, thank you both. Until next time.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit hyland.com.